The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the November 12th, 2021 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a picture of the Earth. It's made to look like a person's face. The eyes look distressed, and there's a huge thermometer coming out of its mouth. It's actually on like a barbecue spit over a fire, and there's sweat beads off the top. The headline is, "A Burning Question, Will the Global Summit Have Any Real Impact on Climate Change?" And that is our second main story, but we'll start with the first one. Republicans buoyed by Youngkin's victory. What happened? The country's political landscape shifted dramatically toward Republicans this week as GOP political newcomer Glenn Youngkin upset veteran Democrat Terry McAuliffe to become governor of Virginia, a state that chose Joe Biden over Donald Trump by 10 percentage points just a year ago. The Democrats' chagrin was deepened in New Jersey, where a presumed easy win for Democratic Governor Phil Murphy turned into an unexpected cliffhanger. Youngkin, a 54-year-old former private equity executive elected by a three-point margin, is the first Republican to win statewide elections since 2009. McAuliffe, Virginia's governor from 2014 to 2018, portrayed his opponent as a Trump stand-in. But Trump was persuaded to stay out of the state, and in what some analysts call a Trump-lite approach, Youngkin, who presented himself as a basketball-playing suburban dad in fleece vests, focused on taxes, education, and what conservatives have labeled critical race theory, which Youngkin vowed to ban on day one. Through ads and on the stump, Youngkin exploited McAuliffe's statement that, "I don't think parents should be telling schools what they should teach." The Republican won back many educated suburbanites whom Trump drove away in 2020, while crushing McAuliffe with rural white working class voters. In New Jersey, Murphy had a narrow lead over Republican former state assemblyman Jack Cittarelli as the week went to press. Murphy assailed Cittarelli for attending a Stop the Steal rally last year and aired an ad overlaying quotes from his rally speech onto images of January 6. Cittarelli focused his attacks on Murphy's record on taxes. New Jersey has the nation's highest property taxes. Registered Democrats outnumber Republicans by more than 1 million in the state, but no Democratic governor before Murphy has won re-election there since 1977. And both New Jersey and Virginia have a history of choosing governors from the opposing party of a new president. In mayoral races, moderate Democrat Eric Adams, a former police officer, became New York City's second black mayor 5 months after narrowly routing more progressive challengers. And in Boston, 36-year-old city councilor Michelle Wu, the daughter of Taiwanese immigrants, became the city's first female and first non-white mayor. What the editorial said. "Wake up, Democrats," said the Wall Street Journal. "The result of this week's gubernatorial races proves that you're on a losing path for the 2022 midterms and beyond." Biden, who ran as a centrist, has tacked leftward on nearly everything. Now he has the opening he needs to finally say no to the left, if he ever intended to. "Republicans should learn from their new political star," said the National Review. Youngkin improved on Trump's margins in every Virginia county, even the already deep red rural ones. He rightly and unapologetically fought against critical race theory, as well as vaccine and mask mandates in schools. And he successfully kept Trump at arm's length without directly criticizing him, giving him a coalition that includes rural GOP base and Trump-wary independents. That'll probably be a winning formula for Republicans in 2022 and beyond, said the Washington Post. But though Youngkin seemed, by nature and background, to be a moderate, the divisive social issues he exploited while adopting a smiling dad persona will do little to make him a good governor. For the sake of all Virginians, let's hope he pivots towards serious policy. What the columnist said. Yes, McAuliffe ran a lousy campaign, said Brett Stevens in the New York Times, but the Democrats' deeper problem lies in their addiction to identity politics. Liberals may claim critical race theory per se isn't taught in public schools, but that's a semantic game. In many public schools, teachers are instilling in young minds that group identity takes precedence over individual merit, that achievement-based success is the result of ancestral privilege, and that anyone who disputes these ideas is a racist who must be silenced and shunned. Call all that what you will, but parents recognize it as ideologically radical, intensely radicalized, and deliberately polarizing. Republicans are far more radical, said Jill Lawrence in USA Today. Their party undermines vaccination against a deadly disease, free fair elections, any action on climate change, and teaching kids anything about our country's history of slavery and racism. Before 2022, Democrats need to step it up, pass the Build Back Better and hard infrastructure legislation, and remind voters that if Trump wins a second term in 2024, our constitutional democracy may crumble. Democrats have only themselves to blame, said Tim Miller in TheBulwark.com. They have written off huge swaths of America, including working class and rural whites. It should have been easy to devise a populist strategy against Youngkin, a multimillionaire whose former firm, the Carlyle Group, was accused of milking money out of a nursing home chain until it went bankrupt. Couldn't Democrats have used his private equity baggage to convince voters that this guy wasn't on their side? And we'll go right into the second main story. Few concrete commitments at climate summit. What happened? World leaders pledged this week to curb methane emissions and end deforestation at the United Nations Climate Summit in Glasgow, a conference many cast as a make-or-break moment for a world increasingly beset by rising seas, droughts, heat waves, and other ills wrought by a warming climate. More than 130 heads of state attended the opening of the two-week COP26 summit, where they heard dire warnings about the urgent need for action on climate change. The clock is kicking down to a detonation that will end human life as we know it, said British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Environmental activists hope the summit will produce concrete plans to meet the central goal of the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement to stop the planet from warming more than 1.5 degrees Celsius, that's 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, above pre-industrial levels. That would require the world to halve greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 and reach net zero emissions by 2050, something no major economy is on track to achieve. Vowing that the U.S. will lead by the power of our example, President Biden joined the leaders of more than 100 nations in signing a pledge to reduce emissions of methane, a potent greenhouse gas released by oil and gas operations, livestock, and landfills, by 30% by 2030. Major methane polluters, including China, Russia, Australia, and India, did not sign the deal. A pledge to end deforestation by 2030, forests soak up excess carbon from the atmosphere, was agreed to by more than 100 countries. Biden called out Chinese President Xi Jinping and Russian President Vladimir Putin for failing to attend the summit. Climate change is just a gigantic issue, he said, and they've walked away. What the editorial said, Glasgow is the moment to go big on climate change, said the Los Angeles Times, and the U.S. is falling short. Biden arrived with no deal in hand to meet the Paris goal, only a stalled reconciliation bill that's been stripped of its most aggressive climate measures by Democratic Senator Joe Manchin from the coal-producing state of West Virginia. Such obstructionism will doom us to suffer endless repeats of this summer's scorching temperatures, fires, and floods. To avoid worse devastation, we need to be doing much more, much faster. This may be the worst-timed summit in histories of the Wall Street Journal. It borders on the bizarre to be debating cuts to fossil fuel usage while Europe faces a winter fuel crisis. Biden is begging OPEC to produce more oil, and electricity-strapped China is firing up its coal-fueled power plants. The real risk we face isn't climate change. It's radical climate regulations that would hamstring industry and devastate developing countries. What the columnist said, China's and Russia's absence from the COP26 is shameful, said Catherine Rampell in the Washington Post. But we're in no position to point fingers. Biden and the Democrats have ruled out implementing a carbon tax, an effective tool to nudge businesses and consumers away from carbon-intensive technology, out of fear that it smacks of sacrifice. As for Republicans, most either deny climate change or claim human ingenuity will fix the problem. For the richest country on earth, the lack of action is embarrassing. The plans being discussed in Glasgow are an elite farce, said Bjorn Lomborg in the New York Post. It's easy for war leaders to talk about grand and costly schemes to save the planet. It's another to ask voters to pay for these draconian climate policies. To cut emissions without sparking an uprising, we should pump investment into fusion and fission technology, solar and wind power, and second-generation biofuels. As soon as we innovate the price of green energy below fossil fuels, real changes will follow. Now that the presidents, prime ministers, and movie stars have left Glasgow, the real work begins, said Michael Birnbaum in the Washington Post. Faceless bean counters will attempt to hammer out the details of a deal involving not only emissions targets, but also billions of dollars in long-promised climate aid to developing countries. It's less lofty work than delivering soaring speeches, but the stakes are far higher. Whether we can summon the collective wisdom to stave off disaster, said British Prime Minister Johnson, still hangs in the balance. Our controversy of the week is the pandemic. Should kids be vaccinated? After 2 years of pandemic misery, sweet relief may finally be at hand, said the Houston Chronicle in an editorial. The Centers for Disease Control voted this week to recommend a low-dosage version of Pfizer's vaccine against COVID-19 for all U.S. children ages 5 to 11, finding it 90% effective against symptomatic disease. With 70% of American adults now fully inoculated, the 28 million 5 to 11-year-olds represent the largest remaining block of the unvaccinated. Data show they can contract and transmit the highly infectious Delta variant as easily as adults, making them a reservoir of infection that stands between us and the end of the pandemic. Mass vaccination of 5 to 11-year-olds could influence the trajectory of the whole pandemic, said Dr. Lena Nguyen in WashingtonPost.com. But the main reason to do it is to protect the kids themselves. At least 1.8 million U.S. children between 5 and 11 have been diagnosed with COVID-19. 8,600 have been hospitalized, and 143 have died. These alarming numbers are even higher for teens. Kids need vaccines to reduce unnecessary risk and to get back the freedom that they have been missing. Getting kids vaccinated in sufficient numbers will be an uphill battle, said Daniela Silva in NBCNews.com. A new Kaiser Family Foundation poll finds only 27% of parents of eligible kids are planning to get them the shot right away, while 30% will definitely not get it for them at all, and 33% want to wait and see. Wariness is perfectly rational, said Kaylee McGee in WashingtonExaminer.com. Young children have a greater chance of dying in the car on the way to school than they do of falling seriously ill from COVID. The Pfizer shot carries a slight risk of myocarditis, an inflammation of the heart. Other childhood vaccines, such as the one against polio, are tried and true defenses against more serious illnesses. The COVID vaccine is clearly safe, said Apurva Mandavii in the New York Times. Of the 2,268 children ages 5 to 11 who received the Pfizer shot in trials, not a single one developed myocarditis, which as a vaccine side effect seems to mainly affect young men in a mild and temporary form. Unvaccinated kids who contract COVID-19, conversely, face a much higher risk of myocarditis, and the virus can also inflict permanent heart damage. In addition, an estimated 1 in 7 will suffer long COVID, a suite of chronic cognitive and neurological problems that last for months. Parents who feel a lack of urgency about getting their kids vaccinated don't realize that Delta changed everything, said Jessica Calarco in NYTimes.com. More kids are getting sick and infecting adults, including causing breakthrough cases among vaccinated family members. To really make a difference, vaccinations for kids will eventually have to join the list of mandatory shots needed to attend school, said Scott Lehigh in the Boston Globe. While the national debate over vaccine mandates for adults has been emotional and divisive, the uproar over kid mandates is likely to be deafening. We must fight the good fight, said Dr. Lee Savio Beers in the New York Times. The health risks of COVID to children are very real, and so is the brutal toll this pandemic has taken on the education and mental health of a generation of children. As a mother and a pediatrician, I know this vaccine is the quickest route to a more normal life for my own kids and for the nation's. Here's our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for Meta, a Canadian material sciences company whose share price surged by 25% last week after Mark Zuckerberg announced that Meta is the name of Facebook's new corporate entity. CEO George Palikaris tweeted that he would like to cordially welcome at Facebook to the hashtag Metaverse. It was a good week for Zoom after Jeff Bezos, Prince Albert of Monaco, and an estimated 400 luminaries flew to the COP26 climate summit in Glasgow on private jets, spewing out millions of pounds of carbon dioxide. And it was a good week for the rule of law after Kohl's issued a recall notice for its ultimate oversized anti-gravity chair, warning it is prone to collapse when weight is applied. But it was a bad week for rocket science, with news that a toilet malfunction on the SpaceX's Crew Dragon capsule will require 4 astronauts on the International Space Station to make the hours-long return trip to Earth with wet undergarments. It was a bad week for personal responsibility after Senator Josh Hawley blamed the left for so demoralizing the nation's men with criticism of toxic masculinity that dudes are withdrawing into the enclave of idleness and pornography and video games. Finally, it was a bad week for prophecy after hundreds of QAnon followers showed up at Dealey Plaza in Dallas, site of JFK's assassination, because of predictions that the late JFK Jr. would appear there and announce that Donald Trump was being reinstated. The crowd, some of whom wore Trump Kennedy 2024 t-shirts, trickled away after a few hours. Thank you. The briefing this week is titled, The Trouble with Polling. Polls are struggling to capture an accurate picture of the American voter. Why? Have polls lost credibility? Yes, in three of the last four national election cycles, 2014, 2016, 2018, and 2020, polls significantly overestimated the performance of Democratic candidates. The polls' poor performance exposed the reality that polling companies face far more challenges today in getting a representative cross-section of people to respond. In an age of ubiquitous cell phones and caller ID, the Pew Research Center estimates that only 6% of the people polling firms call respond, down from nearly 50% in the 1970s and 80s. With many Americans abandoning landline phones, pollsters have been forced to call cell phones. But federal law forbids them from making automated calls to these phones, making polling more expensive. People who still do respond to polls are generally older, whiter, more educated, and more likely to be female than the voting public. Pollsters try to correct for that skew, but the industry, nonetheless, faced a major reckoning after the 2016 presidential election. What happened that year? Most polls predicted that Hillary Clinton would be elected president. In the final days, aggregate polls predicted she'd win the popular vote by 3 percentage points. That turned out to be only 1 point off, well within the stated margin of error. But on a state level, the polls missed a last-minute surge in support for Donald Trump in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. His narrow victories there gave him the Electoral College and the presidency. After that black eye, the American Association for Public Opinion Research, the AAPOR, released guidelines to reduce polling bias, including more heavily weighing white voters without college degrees. Yet 2020 results were even less accurate. Why were the polls so far off? Americans elected Biden with 51.3% of the vote versus Trump's 46.8%, a historically substantial margin. But most polls have predicted an even greater victory margin for Biden and a blue wave of Democrats in the House, which failed to materialize. An AAPOR postmortem published in July found that polls overstated Biden's victory margin by 3.9 percentage points in the final weeks before Election Day, the industry's worst performance in 40 years. Experts aren't sure what skewed the numbers the most, but Vanderbilt University political scientist Joshua Clinton called 2020 pretty much a perfect storm for pre-election polling. First of all, the pandemic changed campaigning and voting norms. One theory is that left-of-center voters were more likely to follow social distancing guidelines and stay home, making them more reachable by phone and thus overrepresented in polls. Secondly, turnout was the highest in more than 100 years, with new and newly energized voters possibly weakening pollsters' likely voter screens. Finally, Trump repeatedly told his supporters not to trust fake polls that showed him trailing, perhaps influencing them to ignore calls from pollsters. Do faulty polls always tilt leftward? No. In 2012, some polls, including Gallup, predicted a narrow victory for Mitt Romney. Instead, Barack Obama was reelected comfortably. Last September, RealClearPolitics.com's poll aggregation suggested that Californians would vote against recalling Governor Gavin Newsom by a 14.5-point margin, but he survived by nearly double that. The polls use enthusiasm to gauge how likely it is that a respondent will vote. California made participation extremely easy, mailing all 22 million of the state's registered voters postage-paid mail-in ballots. As Democratic strategist Gary South said, "This doesn't require enthusiasm, folks." How can polling be fixed? No one's entirely sure, but polling organizations have begun making major changes. 538.com has stopped privileging live caller-only polls, finding that they no longer are more accurate than polls that employ a mix of methods to reach voters, including online, text-based, and interactive voice response systems. Polls are changing what they ask people, too. Pew has added screening questions designed to measure a respondent's trust in institutions, such as whether they volunteer, and weight the mistrustful more heavily, since they're more likely to be underrepresented. Can we trust polls anymore? On balance, yes. Though maybe we should expect a little less of them. All polls have a margin of error, and in close elections, that margin can result in wrong predictions. If a candidate gets, say, 51% of the vote instead of the predicted 49% on election day, headlines deem it an upset, even if that two-point difference is within the estimated margin of error. Because polls are snapshots in time, they can mislead, since events can change how people vote right up to the last minute. In 2016, FBI Director James Comey's announcement that he was looking into Clinton's emails 11 days before the election apparently swung many undecided voters to Trump. Still, even though trust in polls has declined, they'll continue to get a lot of attention as a useful, if imperfect, measure of public opinion. A polling surprise like we had in 2020 is not going to uproot or destroy the industry, said communication scholar W. Joseph Campbell. It's just too profoundly attached to American life. Were there shy Trump voters? Before the 2016 election, Trump campaign manager Kellyanne Conway was among those who claimed he had hidden support from so-called shy voters, who may have told pollsters they were voting for Hillary Clinton out of a fear of negative judgment. The gap between the polls and Trump's victory margin appeared to give credence to that theory. Research has shown 45% of college degree-holding Republicans said they feared losing their jobs if their support of Trump were known. But the shy Trump voter concept remains controversial. In 2020, even online and robocall polls, which offer Trump supporters relative secrecy, overcounted Biden supporters. And the pro-Democratic poll bias was even stronger down ballot. Institutional distrust, encouraged by Trump, instead might have made his supporters reluctant to answer poll questions at all. They were undercounted, in other words, rather than lying to pollsters about their preference. Trump spent the last 4 years beating the crap out of polls, said Republican pollster Neil Newhouse, and a big proportion of his supporters just said, I'm not participating. We're into the best columns of the week, starting with the green case for more nuclear power. When you hear that humans just need to find a reliable, plentiful energy source that doesn't blacken our lungs and burn the planet to a crisp, said Andrew Sullivan, remember that we have already found one. It's called nuclear power. Nuclear plants generate huge amounts of electricity in a compact space without any greenhouse gas emissions, and now provide 52% of the U.S.'s non-carbon energy. These plants actually have a strong safety record compared with coal and other fossil fuels. But few highly publicized accidents, mostly abroad, created an irrational level of fear of nuclear, similar to our fear of sharks. France currently gets 70% of its energy from nuclear plants, spends about half of what Green Germany does to generate electricity, and produces just one-tenth of the carbon emissions. Nuclear plants are expensive to build, But once they're running, they can produce enough energy to end all fossil fuel usage for our electricity. Nuclear power offers an additional advantage. Republicans are enthusiastic about it, partly because most liberal environmentalists hate it. The GOP should embrace nuclear to move from denial to action on climate change, and from the fringe to the center of the debate. Threatening election officials. I am a hunter, and I think you should be hunted. You will never be safe in Arizona again. That, said Isaac Dover and Jeremy Herb, is one of the dozens of phone calls and online threats Arizona's Secretary of State Katie Hobbs has received since the 2020 election. She and other swing state officials who certified Joe Biden's victory have found themselves living in constant terror from callers and online posters who have described their executions for treason in minute, alarming detail. Serving as Secretary of State or as a local election official used to be mundane, unexciting, bureaucratic. Now, as Senate testimony revealed last week, many of these public servants face ongoing threats to themselves and their families. In some counties, as many as 40% of election workers have already decided not to return to their jobs. This campaign of fear and intimidation coincides with Donald Trump's ongoing attempts to replace Republican officials who refuse to conjure evidence of voter fraud, such as Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, with big lie-believing loyalists. As we close in on next year's election in 2024, said Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, I think it will simply continue to escalate. Here's a column from Poland. How Facebook fueled the extreme right. We now know how the far-right Confederation Party radicalized so many Poles so quickly, said Peter Sostak. It had Facebook's help. That's the shocking conclusion of a Washington Post analysis of leaked internal documents from the social media giant. In 2018, Facebook changed its algorithm to promote what it called engaging content, in part by giving posts that had angry emojis five times the reach of those with mere likes. That policy rewarded the once fringe Confederation, which traffics in anti-immigrant and anti-vaccine content, and which went from holding zero seats in Parliament to 11 in just 1 year. Both the ruling right-wing Law and Justice Party and the centrist opposition Civic Platform have complained to Facebook representatives that the company's algorithm is creating an atmosphere of societal civil war online. A Confederation leader, Janusz Korwin-Mikke, was banned from Facebook last year for violating its hate speech rules. But other party officials still flourish there, as do posts from ordinary users spewing its rhetoric. At this point, the Confederation has 665,000 Facebook fans, more than double the 307,000 who follow Law and Justice. At Katarzyna Szmielewicz of the Polish anti-surveillance group Panoptykon says, these revelations have demonstrated the scale of our ignorance and our susceptibility to manipulation. Time for the last word, our feature article, titled this week, Trapped in Trailer 83. Medical debt and climate disaster pushed the Ericksons out of their home and into a FEMA trailer park, said Hannah Dreyer in the Washington Post. Now they wonder if there is anywhere left for them to go. Mike Erickson had been living in the trailer park in Chico, California for 341 days when he saw the new sign. It was unmissable. A blue billboard at the entrance to what had become a place of last resort for families made homeless by the worst wildfire in California history. Its message was unmissable, too. In 12 days, the site would be closing and everyone would have to be out. Mike knew who had put it there, the same agency that had carved his trailer park from nothing after the 2018 fire, transforming a 13-acre field between a cemetery and a set of train tracks into a haven for survivors to start rebuilding their lives. The Federal Emergency Management Agency. Nearly 100 families lived at the site at one point, but one by one they had been moving away until on this day in September, only a handful were left. Mike's trailer was at the farthest end. There were no streets here and no addresses, just small numbers glued to the sides of the trailers. His was 83. He trudged back through the gravel, wondering what to tell his wife. "I thought by now we'd have something figured out," he said. Inside the trailer, his wife, Crystal Erickson, like Mike, 60 years old, was lying in a hospital bed that took up most of the small living room. Partially paralyzed from a stroke and unable to navigate through the gravel with her wheelchair, this is where she spent most of her time. "What's up, honey?" she asked. "FEMA came by." "Same thing as always," he said, trying to sound relaxed. But after 35 years together, she knew when something was wrong. Mike took her hand, patted it, and let go. "Just trust me," he said. Mike and Crystal were in this park because their home had been destroyed by the kind of wildfire that was once heard of in the United States, but that now, after so many others, the Dixie Fire, the Caldor Fire, seems almost routine. Known as the Camp Fire, it had started before dawn in November 2018, raced through terrain made tender dry by drought, burned down almost every house in the mountain town of Paradise, and killed 85 people and displaced 50,000, including Mike and Crystal. They were among the last to evacuate and had driven through thick black smoke, listening to the pop of propane tanks exploding. They moved to the FEMA trailer park in September 2020. Before that, Crystal had spent 6 months in the hospital while Mike had bounced between motels and campsites. They also lived temporarily at a different FEMA site, but Trailer 83 seemed to offer a kind of stability they hadn't experienced since before the fire. With 11 days left before the deadline to move out, Mike flipped through a notebook where he'd written down the names and numbers of every official he had spoken with since the fire. The first person he reached was a young woman at a social services agency. He told her about who he had once been, a man who had coached his son's little league team, held a steady job, owned a home, and lost that home in 2016, buried in medical debt after his wife's stroke. He said they moved to a rental with their 18-year-old son, Ronald, who helped care for Crystal while he worked. Ronald had initially moved to Trailer 83 too, but FEMA had said he couldn't stay because he wasn't on his parents' paperwork. And with no one to help Crystal during the day, Mike couldn't work. And so they were living on her disability payments of $2,800 a month, $1,799.31 of which FEMA was now billing them, for because a few months earlier, overwhelmed, he had missed turning in proof of his fruitless rental searches. By the time he got around to telling the woman that they were about to be evicted, she was letting him know that she couldn't help. "We really don't have room for new cases," she said, but offered to connect him with another nonprofit. After a while, Crystal fell asleep and Mike slipped out for a walk. There was no greenery at the site, no shade, and no color aside from the green trash bins outside each home. He walked past Trailer 46, where a small woman who liked to keep herself peeked out through the blinds, past Trailer 11, where a father, preparing to move out, was trying to scrape off the glow-in-the-dark stars he'd put up for his kids, past Trailer 7, where a FEMA eviction notice fluttered on the door, warning, "We have not been able to contact you by telephone, and must speak with you right away. Mike knew that the man who had lived inside had a hole in his trachea and couldn't talk. The next evening, Mike and Crystal's daughter Rita came by. She'd lost her home in the fire too, and like their son, was barred from the extra trailer bedroom. She lived a few blocks away in a tent under an oak tree. Paradise Fire survivors made up about a third of Chico's growing homeless population, and many had moved into the 100-person encampment where Rita was staying. Rita didn't talk about all that went on there, like the man who had been stabbed to death in a fight a few weeks earlier, as she watched with horror, prompting her to start carrying a hunting knife in her bra and another in her backpack. When she walked in, Crystal's mood changed. "Give me a kiss," she called. There were tasks Rita did almost immediately whenever she visited. She combed Crystal's hair, trimmed her fingernails, gave her sponge baths. Mike did everything else. He checked Crystal's blood sugar 5 times a day. He made her meals and helped feed her. He put fresh bandages on the bed sores she'd been developing. And sometimes he left her alone, as he did one morning with 7 days left before the deadline. He tried to get out every day to clear his head, even if it was just to hit a few golf balls and watch them skip across the gravel. Before he left, Crystal asked him to straighten her in bed so she could breathe better. Some things Crystal only let herself think about when she was alone, like how badly she'd deteriorated since the fire. After her stroke, she had still been able to sit up on her own, but with no physical therapy in more than 2 years, she'd grown weak and rigid. The only person who had come out was a nurse who monitored her blood thinning medication for a while, then said she had to stop because the gravel leading to the trailer was damaging her car. Lately, Crystal was sleeping with the overhead light on because of a dream she'd been having in which she had been sent to hell for being a burden on her family. When Mike got back from the store, she told him about how she was longing to see trees and grass. "I feel stupid for wanting that," she said. "It's not stupid," Mike said, and proposed that at least go out to the porch. It was a 10-minute process to get her out of bed by himself. He rolled her back and forth to get her into a net, which he then attached to a lifting machine. He began pumping a lever to lift the net into the air. When Crystal was suspended, he maneuvered her toward a wheelchair and then hit the lever again to lower her until she could sit. Outside, the air was dry and full of ash from 2 wildfires burning nearby. Minutes passed. She was smiling. Then she looked uncertain. Then she was in pain from her bed sores and started crying. Then she was calling out for Mike, who had gone inside to do the dishes. He rushed her back in and hoisted her in the net as her crying turned to screaming. "Oh, God, just do it," she screamed, suspended now above the bed. But Mike was afraid of letting her fall and was so focused that he didn't hear the crunch of approaching cars. It wasn't until someone was knocking that he looked out and saw 2 FEMA security guards and 2 women who were strangers. "Give me a minute," he yelled, but the knocking got louder, and so Mike paused and threw the doors open, revealing Crystal suspended in the net, clothed in only a T-shirt. "You might as well get a front row seat," Mike said to the group. The guards looked aghast and took a step back. "You want to know why we haven't gotten out of here? I'm doing this all day long," Mike slammed the door. "You're doing good," he said to Crystal as he lowered her into bed and pulled up her sheet. A FEMA supervisor called to say that if the Ericksons were not out by the deadline, they would be trespassing, and he would call the police. "I'm sorry about it, but that's the way he goes," it said. "We're at the end of the game. It's really in your best interest to move on." 2 days left to go now, and FEMA workers were showing up to collect keys from the remaining tenants. By that evening, the only trailer left in the park with anyone still home was the one where Crystal was in her hospital bed and Mike was on the porch when a truck pulled up. The man who got out had dozens of colorful tattoos over his arms and legs, and he handed Mike a business card that said, Stephen Murray, campfire supervisor supporter. He explained that he had helped others facing eviction from FEMA parks and had heard from a friend of a friend that the Ericksons were about to be put on the street. I'm going to at least try to get you in a hotel for a few nights, he said before he left. What an unbelievable place this is, Mike thought as he leaned with his elbows on the porch railing. Created out of nothing, about to be nothing again. And his last version of hope, coming down to a man who had the slogan, Stephen Murray spreading love tattooed on his biceps and etched into a rubber bracelet, which he had slipped off his wrist and onto crystals. For 3 years now, it had been one strange and heartrending thing after another. Going back to those first weeks after the fire when Mike was living at a campground and had seen people clutching blankets and struggling to speak coherently. I used to look down on them and think, can't you pull yourself out of that? But now I can't pull myself out of it either, he said. With one day left now, when Mike woke up, he was struck by how quiet the park had become. In that silence, his phone rang. Finding a handicapped hotel room in California is hard, Stephen said, but I've got one. And just like that, the Ericksons had a place lined up. It would be for a week, Stephen said he would pay for it. He also rented a storage unit and would send someone for the hospital bed. Mike had some boxes saved, and he started taping them together. He didn't need many. There wasn't much to pack, mostly donated clothes and kitchen supplies. It didn't take long. An hour and 14 small boxes. Now that they had a destination, Mike arranged for a paratransit bus to come. He rolled the lifting machine through the trailer for the last time, swung Crystal in the net, and lowered her in the wheelchair. Nothing more to do but sit and wait. Way too quiet in here, Mike said, and unpacked the radio so he could listen to music. At last, there was the sound of tires on gravel, and a friend of Stephen's took the boxes and the bed. Another rumble and the bus arrived. Mike followed Crystal down the ramp, leaving the trailer door open. He helped strap her in and paid their fare. As the bus began rolling away, Mike was remembering the early days when they first moved in, before their son left. The kids not being able to stay with us, that just tore our family apart, he said. The bus passed through the fence and turned right, and the Ericksons were gone. Except for a few things they had left behind. A lawn chair, a fan, a mirror, a mop. All of it noted by a FEMA inspector who came later that day. Okie dokie, he said. I've seen a lot worse. There was nothing to break the silence as midnight came and then went, and the park was officially closed. At the motel across town, Crystal was asleep, and Mike, who had been so excited when they arrived that he jumped into the pool with a whoop, lay awake in bed. They'd ordered a pizza and watched a movie, and when they got tired, Crystal had asked Mike to leave the overhead lights on. Now, as she slept, he stared up at them, thinking that they couldn't afford to stay beyond the week Stephen had booked. They would need to find somewhere to go. He had 6 days left to figure it out. A version of this story originally appeared in the Washington Post. We're on the health and science page. Elephants evolving to lose tusks. Poachers killed so many elephants for their ivory during the 1977 to 1992 Mozambican Civil War that the animals rapidly evolved to be naturally tuskless. That's the astonishing finding of a new study by Princeton researchers, said New Scientist. Male and female African elephants usually have tusks, essentially a pair of giant teeth, but a few were born without. Because so many of the species were killed during the war, the tuskless elephants were much more likely to pass on their genes. Researchers found that the proportion of females without tusks rose from 19% to 51% during the conflict. They also found that the genetic mutation for tusklessness is lethal to males, and that those who have it die, sometimes before birth. The pace of the evolutionary change had shocked researchers, and lead author Shane Campbell-Staton says that although the loss of tusks may stop females from being poached, it denies them a tool that is used to strip bark off trees for food, dig holes for water, and defend themselves. Selection always comes at a cost, he says, and that one cost is lives. And we're over on the Talking Points page to finish up the show. Here's Trump 2024. Yes, he may run again. Former President Trump is telling most anyone who'll listen that he will run again in 2024, said Mike Allen and Margaret Tlaib and Axios.com. And the GOP nomination is clearly his if he wants it. Trump has been holding raucous campaign-style rallies and raising more than $1 million per week, giving him an astonishing $100 million war chest. A new Quinnipiac poll shows 78% of Republicans want Trump to run again, and would-be GOP rivals such as Nikki Haley and Governor Ron DeSantis are afraid to challenge his domination of the party. It would take a severe illness, death, or criminal charges sticking to stop Trump. Democrats and never-Trump Republicans need a wake-up call, said Tim Miller in TheBulwark.com. With President Biden's approval ratings dropping into the low 40s, a wannabe authoritarian lunatic who incited a mob to overthrow our democracy is the odds-on favorite to make a comeback. Everyone who doesn't want to see a second Trump term better do everything possible to prevent it, starting now. A lot can change in 3 years, said Rich Lowry in the New York Post. Up to now, Trump has clung to his fanciful stolen election narrative to avoid the stench of defeat, having lost in 2020 by 7 million votes. But he was and remains repellent to suburban moderates and independents. As 2024 nears, Republican opponents will raise the question of whether his big mouth alienates too many voters, and that punch will land. Most Trump fans, however, don't see him as unelectable, said Mackenzie Wilkes in 538.com, especially if he runs against an unpopular 82-year-old Biden. Republicans will be even more optimistic if the opponent is Vice President Kamala Harris, whose approval ratings are even worse than Biden's. If Trump does run, said David Frum in TheAtlantic.com, his main motivation will be revenge. Trump once explained his life's motto thusly, get even with people, screw them back 10 times as hard. He's worked to punish every Republican who abandoned him after the January 6th Capitol riot, and his speeches have turned darker and angrier. If there is a second Trump presidency, he won't surround himself with Washington establishment types like John Kelly and James Mattis, who checked his craziest impulses. His next administration will be filled top to bottom with loyalists who will do whatever he commands. That's the future Trump is preparing. Be ready. And a few short notes. A large-scale study found that a third dose of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine led to 95.6% efficacy in preventing symptomatic COVID infection. In Israel, people who've received a Pfizer-BioNTech booster have been infected at a rate more than 10 times lower than those who didn't get a booster, according to a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine. The coronavirus has killed more than 5 million people globally and caused nearly 250 million confirmed infections. The U.S. leads the world in coronavirus cases and deaths, with over 700,000 deaths and nearly 46 million cases. It is followed in case counts by Brazil, India, Mexico, and Russia. Drivers drove their vehicles into protesters at least 139 times between late May 2020 and the end of September 2021, killing three people and injuring at least 100. A nationwide analysis indicates that only 65 of the ramming cases led to any charges, with only four drivers convicted of felonies. Tropical Storm Wanda became the 21st named storm of the Atlantic season last week. All the names on the official storm list were used this year, making 2021 the Atlantic's third most active year for tropical storms and hurricanes on record. The poll watch, 62% of Americans say they will trust the results of the 2024 election, even if their candidate loses, including 82% of Democrats, but only 33% of Republicans. And we'll finish out the show today with a quote from clergyman and abolitionist Henry Ward Beecher, quoted in the Montreal Gazette, who says, "A man without mirth is like a wagon without springs, in which one is caused to jolt disagreeably by every pebble over which it runs." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.